Spring, traditionally, is the peak season for home sales, but this year the warming temperatures aren't expected to pull the real estate market out of a deep freeze. Housing starts plunged more than 22% last month, the second worst reading since World War II. Home prices and sales continued to drop, too. In fact, millions of Americans have given up the dream of owning homes. They are renters now and will stay that way. Here to discuss why some economists say that change might not be all bad is NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax. Nice to see you again.
Hi, Leanne.
What's your evidence that many Americans are giving up on home ownership?
The evidence is pretty clear now. Rents are up and apartment vacancies are down. And while home prices are still falling, apartment building values have been shooting up. One study I was looking at showed that the value of these apartment buildings rose 16% last year.
We keep hearing the U.S. economy is improving, so why aren't home sales improving as well?
Well, here's the problem. We literally have had millions of people lose their homes to foreclosures, and now their credit ratings are really bad, and they can't meet the tighter lending standards, so they won't be able to buy a house for years, maybe forever. In addition, we've got a weak job market and slow wage growth, and that's making it harder for Americans, even people with good credit histories, to come up with the down payments, so they're renting instead. And then there's been a psychological change. A lot of younger people are really turned off to ownership. They've seen their parents get stuck with these houses whose values are underwater. And so economists estimate now that Americans have lost more than $6 trillion in collective housing wealth. So seeing those kinds of losses, young people just aren't as eager as previous generations to rush into buying a house.
But home buying spins off jobs. Carpenters, bricklayers, plumbers, landscapers. Yeah, I mean, won't a shift to renting hurt that sector of the economy?
You raise a good point there. Certainly a lot of jobs are tied to home buying and home building. But some economists say that individuals and the economy as a whole would be better off if we had more renters. It used to be that owning a big home in the suburbs was a reasonable proposition because energy was cheap. People could afford to air condition those great rooms, you know, with the high ceilings, and they could fill their gas tanks to make long commutes. Remember, 15 years ago, gasoline cost about $1.20 a gallon. Remember that?
Yeah.
But now we've got energy prices that are rising, and the cost of that big house lifestyle is going to go up, too. So if you rent an apartment closer to your job, it's true you won't build up that much home equity, but you could afford to divert more of your paycheck into a retirement account. Now, that takes more self-discipline than just paying your mortgage, but 401k deductions and those long-term investments, they could rise a lot more in value than residential real estate.
Marilyn, does all of this fundamentally change the American dream?
The notion that owning property is the key step towards building personal wealth, it's been around a long time. It got a boost during the first term of President George W. Bush, who promoted this idea of what he called the ownership society. He wanted to increase home ownership as a way to reduce poverty. And while home values were rising, that idea seemed to be working out pretty well. Ownership rates jumped to a record 69.2% in 2004. But then the housing crisis hit and home ownership rates started dropping down to 66.5%. And now we're at the lowest level since 1998. But some economists say that's okay because we really don't need an ownership society as much as we need an innovation society, one where workers are flexible and willing to move wherever there is a job opportunity.
So you're saying owning a home could slow you down?
Yes, actually. In fact, in places with high rates of home ownership, the jobless rates tend to be high, too. If you look at, like, Detroit or northeastern Ohio, jobless homeowners who might be able to find work elsewhere in the country might feel stuck because the real estate market is stagnant and they can't sell their homes. So if you're a renter, it's easier to pick up and move if you can find a better job or a promotion opens up in another city. And then, really, that's the American dream, too, moving up the ladder to boost your income.
NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax. Thanks a lot, Marilyn.
You're welcome, Leanne.
Americans who want to buck the rental trend may have a tough time going forward. The collapse of the housing bubble has made it hard for many prospective homeowners to qualify for financing. Now, the government is reshaping the mortgage market in ways that make it even more difficult. There's also another potential roadblock, strong political support for requiring much bigger down payments for most home loans. Powerful congressional Democrats and Republicans are behind it, as is the Obama administration. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
In a matter of weeks, federal regulators are expected to unveil new rules for home loans. And the buzz right now is that the rules could translate into mandatory 10 or even 20% down payments for most new loans in the U.S. That would be a very big change. For the average home, it would mean saving $18,000 to $36,000 before you could buy the house. And some experts think that's a good idea.
We put too many people into houses that weren't qualified to buy. They didn't have the income. They didn't have skin in the game.
Ed Pinto is a fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. He thinks that requiring 20% down is probably going too far. He favors a 10% down payment rule. He says that would be good evidence of a person's ability to handle owning a house.
And if people know they need the down payments, they will start saving for them. I mean, you can't just buy lattes if you need to be saving for down payments.
But some economists and housing advocates don't like the proposed down payment rules. They say this would set the country back 30 years in terms of the ability for minorities and people without family money to buy houses. Mike Calhoun is the president of the nonprofit Center for Responsible Lending. He estimates it would take 7 years for the average American to save up even a 10% down payment.
Which, if it made a big difference in the performance of mortgages, would be worth it. But the real key is not the down payment.
Calhoun says some loans with smaller down payments actually perform quite well. He says the housing bubble and subsequent foreclosure mess happened mainly because lenders got sloppy in other ways. For example, those no-doc loans where banks didn't even check to see if a homebuyer made enough money to pay back the loan.
All those other safeguards were totally abandoned.
Now, if what you say is true and the down payment really isn't the important factor when it comes to making a good loan, why does there seem to be so much talk and so much support right now for requiring a 10 or 20% down payment?
I think it's bailout shock that the taxpayers got stuck with a big bailout. And so people sort of want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, let's never do anything like that again.
The down payment is just one big change. Lawmakers are talking about dismantling the government-backed home loan companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And Ed Pinto explains, for decades, Fannie and Freddie have subsidized one of the bedrocks of the current mortgage industry, the 30-year fixed-rate loan.
That exists because the government subsidizes it.
Going forward, banks might prefer to push borrowers towards shorter-term, say, 20-year fixed-rate loans instead. In most other countries, shorter-term loans are much more common, but going in that direction could also make it more expensive to buy a house. Mike Calhoun doesn't like that, but Ed Pinto says in the long run, it might actually help homeowners.
The problem with the 30-year loan, it amortizes incredibly slowly.
In other words, homeowners pay off a ton of interest up front in the first years, and it takes a long time to pay off what they actually owe. 20-year loans do have moderately higher monthly payments, but Pinto says borrowers would quickly find themselves owning a bigger chunk of their houses. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Here's how a lot of mortgage brokers make money. The bigger the interest rate on a loan, the higher their commission. In a few days, new federal rules will change that. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
Say you're buying a house and you go to a mortgage broker for a loan. The broker arguably has an incentive to steer you into a higher interest rate. Now, there are many mortgage brokers out there who don't do this, but let's say you qualify for a 5% interest rate. If instead the broker tells you, well, the best they can get you is a 6 or maybe even a 7% interest rate, and you don't shop around and you take it, the broker makes more money.
They basically received a kickback from the lender.
Ira Reingold heads up the National Association of Consumer Advocates. He says that during the recent housing bubble, many homeowners got gouged by brokers.
They made more money when they were able to stick you with a loan that was worse than what you otherwise would have qualified for.
And up until now, that's been perfectly legal. So Reingold is happy to see the new rules from the Federal Reserve that will ban brokers from making extra money this way.
It's about time. The April 1st rules, I think, simply will begin to create a place where consumers have a better chance of not being cheated in the consumer marketplace when they're buying a mortgage.
But many mortgage brokers, as you might imagine, see all this a little bit differently.
People say that, oh, it's a kickback. Well, it really isn't a kickback.
Robert Petrelli is the owner of Mount Vernon Mortgage Company, which is located south of Boston. He's been in the banking and mortgage business since 1971, and he's a former president of the state's Mortgage Broker Trade Group.
So here's a rate sheet from one of the major banks out there.
At his desk, Petrelli explains how mortgage brokers make their money. Brokers like him get a wholesale price for a loan from a bank. It's basically the same way retail shoe stores or grocery stores pay wholesale prices.
It's just wholesale prices versus retail prices. We get a wholesale price versus getting the actual retail price when you go into the shop.
To stay in business, he has to charge something extra to cover his overhead and make a living. In the mortgage business, that's called a yield spread premium, and that's what's being regulated in these new rules. But Petrelli says there's nothing inherently wrong with it. It's really just like a shoe store might get its shoes for $50 and charge a customer $60.
To be able to operate profitably.
So what you're saying is it's actually the building blocks of how reputable, honest mortgage brokers make their money.
Absolutely, positively, 100% correct.
Petrelli says some brokers clearly overcharge their customers, but these new rules will change the way this entire industry gets paid. And many in the business say the new rules aren't fair. Mike Anderson is the head of government affairs for the National Association of Mortgage Brokers.
If this goes through on April 1st, there will be a tremendous amount of layoffs. We are hearing from mortgage brokers across the country that they're going to let all their loan officers go and become a one-man shop.
Anderson says in writing the new rules, the Federal Reserve has favored big banks at the expense of small mortgage broker businesses. He says the big banks will be allowed more flexibility in what they can charge customers, but he says mortgage brokers will be locked into a set profit margin that will tie their hands and make it hard to compete. He says it'll even be hard for them to lower their fees for customers.
Imagine that you and I are both Ford dealerships, and we're both selling Ford F-150 pickups. And we're across the street from one another. What if I could lower my price every day, but you were not allowed to lower your price? It's not going to be long before you go out of business, Chris. The winners in this rule are going to be the big banks. The losers will be the mortgage brokers.
Consumer advocates say that Anderson is exaggerating. Still, Anderson's trade group has filed a lawsuit in federal court against the Federal Reserve, seeking an injunction to postpone the new rules. But unless a judge intervenes, the new rules are set to go into effect this Friday. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world, and that's been seen as a business opportunity. This morning, we bring you the second half of an NPR investigation into a $3 billion private prison industry.
Texas, where law and order meet free enterprise, has more for-profit prisons than any other state. But because of an inmate shortage, some private jails cannot fill their empty cells, and some towns wish they'd never gotten into the business of prisons. NPR's John Burnett reports.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. The West Texas farming town of Littlefield needed jobs to keep its young people from moving to Lubbock or Dallas. In 2000, the town borrowed $10 million and built the Bill Clayton Detention Center, a charmless steel and cement block building in a cotton field south of town. For 8 years, the prison was a good employer. Idaho and Wyoming paid for prisoners to serve time here. Today, the facility is empty, and a reporter's visit is an opportunity for a free classified ad.
I don't know. Maybe this will be an advertisement where he'll help us to find somebody.
Littlefield City Manager Danny Davis is looking for someone to run this 372-bed medium security prison with double security fences, state-of-the-art control room, a gymnasium, law library, and five living pods.
Each cell will house two inmates. You can see the facility here. That's pretty austere.
2 years ago, Idaho pulled out all of its contract inmates. Shortly afterwards, the for-profit operator, Geo Group, gave notice that it was leaving too. 100 prison jobs disappeared. Today, Littlefield has to come up with $65,000 every month to pay the note on the prison. That's $10 for every resident of this little city.
Is this empty prison a big white elephant for the city of Littlefield?
Is it something we have that we'd rather not have? Well, today, that would probably be the case.
To avoid default, Littlefield has raised property taxes, increased water and sewer fees, and laid off city employees. Still, the city's bond rating has tanked. The village elders drinking coffee at the White Kitchen Cafe are not happy about the way things have turned out.
It was never voted on by the citizens of Littlefield. It's stuck in their craw. They're going to have to pay for it. And the people that got it going is all left here and gone. And left us with
Just holding the bag. They sure did.
This observation by Carl Enlow and Tommy Kelton, both retired from Atmos Energy, could be made all across Texas. For 20 years, it seemed like every small town wanted to be a prison town. But the building boom is over, and now there are too many prisons in Texas. Some corrections facilities are struggling outside the state, too. The city of Hardin, Montana, cannot find enough inmates, and it defaulted on its prison bond payments. And a private prison in Huerfano County, Colorado, is looking everywhere for convicts. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the total correctional population in the United States is declining for the first time in 3 decades. The reasons? The crime rate is falling, sentencing alternatives mean fewer felons doing hard time, and states everywhere are slashing budgets. In Texas today, more than half of all privately operated county jail beds are empty, according to the Texas Commission on Jail Standards. Shannon Herklotz is an assistant director.
Too many times we've seen jails that have got into it and tried to make it a profitable business to make money off of it and they end up falling on their face.
The packages look sweet. A town gets a new detention center with no tax dollars. The private operator finances, constructs, and operates it. Then the prisoners pay off the debt and generate revenue. The economic model works fine until they can't find inmates. In Waco, the county borrowed nearly $50 million to build an oversized jail. But today, because of the convict shortage, the fortress east of town remains more than half empty. Former McLennan County Deputy Rick White, who opposed the jail, had this to say about the prison developers who put the deal together.
They get the corporations formed, they get the bonds sold, they get the facility built, their money is front-loaded, they take their money out, and then there is no reason for them to support the success of the facility.
Two of Texas's busiest private prison consultants, James Parkey and Herb Bristow, declined repeated requests for interviews. Private prison companies insist their future is sunny. GEO declined to comment on the Littlefield prison, but the company highlighted new inmate contracts and prison expansions across the country. Corrections Corporation of America says the demand for its facilities remains strong, particularly for federal immigration detainees. New Jersey-based Community Education Centers has lately been pulling out of unprofitable jails all across Texas. The company released a statement that the current population fluctuation is cyclical. With the paucity of inmates, more and more county officials find themselves in the odd position of looking for jailbirds to lock up.
If somebody is out there charging $30 a day for an inmate, we need to charge $28. We really don't have a choice of not filling those beds.
Falls County Judge Steve Sharp in Central Texas is trying to hustle up inmates to fill the for-profit addition on his jail. Over in the West Texas town of Anson, Jones County Judge Dale Spurgeon has a brand new $34 million prison and an $8 million county jail, both of which sit empty. The state prison system reneged on a contract and left his county in the lurch.
The market certainly has changed nationwide in the course of maybe the last 18 months or 2 years. Certainly a different picture than when we started this project.
Grayson County, north of Dallas, said no to privatizing its jail. 2 years ago, they were all set to build a $30 million, 750-bed behemoth twice as big as they needed, but the public got queasy and county officials scuttled the deal. A leading opponent, Bill Majors, mayor of the county seat of Sherman, said it just felt wrong.
When you put the profit motive into a private jail, by design, in order to increase your dollars, your revenues, your profits, you need more folks in there and they need to stay longer.
Crawford! Go, Crawford. Charles! Face the wall for me.
When the supply of prison beds exceeds the demand, there are winners. The overcrowded Harris County Jail in Houston, the nation's third largest, farms out about 1,000 prisoners to private jails. Littlefield and most other under-occupied facilities in Texas have been in touch with Houston. Captain Robin Konetsky is in charge of inmate processing.
It really is a buyer's market right now, especially a county of our size. They're really wanting to get our business. So we're getting good deals.
Nearby, disheveled and unsmiling men are brought from a holding cell to stand before a booking officer.
How much you weigh, sir?
165.
Married, single, divorced, separated?
Single.
These tattoos?
Three.
They are unaware that they may soon become the newest commodities in the inmate market. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
You can read related stories about the GEO Group and what's happening in a Mississippi town that has become reliant on profits from a troubled youth prison. That's at NPR.org.